shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. True for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Rubenstein, who's a university professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 8 books, including When Jesus Became God and Aristotle's Children. His most recent book is Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Rubenstein.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And last week, the UN launched an inquiry into the impact on civilians of drone strikes and other targeted killing, talking about the exponential rise of drone technology requiring a proper legal framework to be put in place. How do you put the toothpaste back in the tube in terms of drones? Because obviously they're going to proliferate. And I believe at this point, 51 countries have them. Therefore, the U.S. has a temporary advantage, just as it did with the atomic bomb.
Yes. And the question that sort of looms over all of this is not just the technology, not just the fact that there's a new weapon, but what's the purpose of using it? How is it being used? What's the purpose of using it? And I'm afraid that one of the purposes of using the new weapon is to pursue military objectives in far-off places, to be sure. But it also has a political purpose, and that's to make this kind of warfare, make continued warfare on almost every continent, acceptable to American people, to make questions disappear. Questions like, what are we really doing over there? Whose interests are we protecting, or whose interests are we serving? And in addition to the question of how many innocent people are getting hurt because of collateral damage and so forth, there's the deeper question of whether we haven't developed a system of permanent warfare in which the executive branch, the president at his own discretion, kills whom he wants to kill, anywhere he wants to kill him, and there no questions are asked. No questions are asked by Congress. No questions are. Fortunately, there are now questions being asked by the people online and bloggers and so forth, and also by some Congress people. The Progressive Caucus in Congress is now starting to get itchy about this because it really begins to look as though, because these weapons are portrayed as being surgically accurate, and because they're not involving a lot of body bags with American troops coming home, dead, and because sometimes the American actions are undertaken in conjunction with other powers, European powers, NATO powers, and so forth, this is a very alarming, in my view, a really very alarming shift, because it's really designed to make us stop worrying about war and peace, and to just leave the war and peace questions to the government, to the military and the president. This is really unhealthy in a democracy. So I'm glad that the UN is making waves, and I wish that we would make more waves about it here.
Well, of course, the irony is, given our earlier conversations in the program today about how the judiciary, the Republican-appointed judiciary, is moving to curtail presidential authority over recess appointments. And, of course, at the same time, they're only too happy to give the president unlimited authority in national security issues like targeted killing in Guantanamo.
That's right. I think that's true of many conservatives, although it's not true of, the Ron Paul wing of that movement. Is as concerned as the left is about this excessive presidential authority. But, it seems to me that the kind of bottom line here, that the whole debate is going to continue in a sort of, hollow way, unless we start talking more substantively about what the United States is doing abroad with all of this military power and whether they have to be doing this. The general feeling that's being sold to the people by the Obama administration as well as by many conservatives is that you're dealing with terrorists who are such bad guys, the jihadists and so forth, that you just have to kill them before they kill you. And if you find a more efficient way to do it, like a drone, why not use the drone? Which begs the whole question of what are the sources of these extreme Islamist movements? And is there any way to deal with them other than kill or be killed? I'm absolutely convinced that what we're dealing with is a complicated historical phenomenon that needs to be analyzed, and that on the basis of that kind of good analysis, we can find ways to try to deal with, you know, the basic needs of people who are acting out in a very vicious way. I mean, I'm not apologizing for jihadist, you know, violence. I think you have some people there who are bad guys, all right. But they're not bad guys because they're bad. They're bad guys because of the situation that makes good people act savage sometimes. So we need to analyze the situation and say, what is it? For example, lots of people in the Arab world and the Persian world are under the impression that the United States wants to make all the important decisions for them, and if not the United States, then Europe and the United States, that they have no power, that they're constantly being humiliated and made to feel powerless, and they're constantly having decisions on what to produce and what to buy and what kind of policies to have and so forth made for them by the West. Of course, that's true. You know, the United States and Europe decided to get rid of Gaddafi in Libya because they, a phony reason, they said they were afraid that he was going to kill all the, you know, kill the zillions of Libyan civilians. But if that had really been the reason for the intervention in Libya, then the intervention would have stopped as soon as Gaddafi turned back from Benghazi. Instead of which, you know, the U.S. and NATO forces followed him until they destroyed him. They wanted regime change. And they got the regime change. And then, as a result of blowback, as a result of the regime change, we now have Tuareg rebels who were formerly loyal to Gaddafi trying to overthrow the government of Mali. And now we, et cetera, we have Libyan jihadists attacking the oil installations in Algeria, et cetera. Or, you know, if you look at Syria and you say, here's a horribly difficult situation in Syria. You have a guy in power who is a dictator and who's brutal, but who had also represents a lot of the people in Syria, think he's okay, and had kept things together in that country. Then the U.S. and the U.S. allies start to arm this kind of ragtag opposition, which still has no political coherence and no political program, and they managed to create enough chaos in Syria so that millions of people are now refugees from Syria. I don't want to go on and on about this. I want to say two things about it. One, the United States and the Europeans can't seem to stop meddling in the Arab world. Two, when they do meddle, they make things worse. They don't solve problems with this kind of military, whether it's drones or conventional forces. You don't solve problems through military action. You solve problems through getting people together, sitting down with some good facilitation, finding out what's really on people's minds, why they're really pissed off, and then trying to restructure things so that they get what they want. You know, so that it's, you know, when we have an oil installation in Algeria attacked by jihadists, and all we can do is say, oh, those jihadists, aren't they terrible? We're not saying, wait a minute, who owns that oil? And why are we protecting the people who own the oil? And, you know, kind of what's it all about? Why are we over there in the first place? And why are we resorting to military actions when we could be doing all sorts of other things? We could be doing diplomacy. We could be doing talking. We could be doing problem solving in numbers of ways that have proven successful in lots of places around the world. And I think the answer is that there are people, there are interests in the U.S., in Europe, around the world, who want a permanent state of war, because that's the way they're protecting their financial interests. That's the way they're protecting their geopolitical interests. And they either don't have the imagination or they don't care that there are almost always alternatives to this kind of military activity.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Rubenstein, who's a university professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 8 books, including When Jesus Became God and Aristotle's Children. His most recent book is Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. Now, it's interesting, Richard, that you bring up the Sahel and Algeria, Libya and Mali and the current war there with the French intervention. I've had lately on the program, I had the former U.S. ambassador to Mali, Vicky Huddleston, making the argument that, in fact, because the U.S. has been preoccupied in Iraq and Afghanistan, it wasn't watching this area where the remnants of that hideous civil war in Algeria had moved into northern Mali. And then when Gaddafi fell, all those arms became available to them. And now we are suffering the blowback from our neglect in the region. And my impression was that what she was really arguing was that we should have been doing more drone activity and either targeting the jihadis or watching them or whatever, because now, because we neglected it, they formed an army and they're heavily armed, and now, of course, they try to take over the country, requiring the French to intervene. So that seems to be the argument that we're getting from our national security community, and it's worth noting that the person who is apparently most responsible for increasing dramatically the drone program in the United States, John Brennan, is now going to be head of the CIA.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, it's sort of falling under the rubric, at least in some people, the way some people are looking at it, it's falling under the rubric of soft power. Soft power, smart power, you know, we're hearing a lot about that. Which really amounts to translate that, it's imperialism light. It's imperialism without the costs that formerly had to be paid for imperialism. And what people don't seem to want to ask is there an alternative to imperialism? So it's not that Huddleston's position is unintelligent, you know. I mean, it's not stupid to say that what she said, but it's unimaginative. You know, it's wildly unimaginative, because it suggests that the only thing you can do when you have this threat is, you know, meet it in a military way. So folks are not asking, well, are there policy issues, are there policy moves that the United States and other great powers could make on the world stage that would basically make this problem become obsolete after a while? For example, if people in the North African region finally got the impression that they could actually make the decisions about how they wanted to live their lives, whether it's what kind of religion they wanted to practice, how their natural resources would be developed, what they wanted their international political stance to be, and so forth. And if they were encouraged to form a regional organization, this is my friend Johan Galtung, you know, the Norwegian peacemaker, is constantly talking about the need for regional organizations to empower people in regions that are not the West to make decisions about their own resources and their own destinies. You know, one of the main planks of the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and all of those organizations, one of the main things they're selling is unity. They say to the people, look, we've been divided artificially by the Western powers. We'll offer you a chance to overcome these divisions of tribe and nationality and to have a united front, you know, against the West. Well, that's very appealing. I mean, if I was over there, just an ordinary person living over there, I might find that enormously appealing, because I know that I'm living in a world that's been divided by outsiders and kept powerless by outsiders. And I know I'm being told it's no business of yours what we do with the oil here. That's our, we own it, we'll do what we want with it, etc. So the conversation that I think we need to have is about new models of world order. Richard Falk has been talking about this for years, and he's absolutely right, that the alternative to having a permanent state of war representing this, what I called imperialism light, drone imperialism instead of armies imperialism, is a model that's not imperialist, that gives regions around the world the right to make decisions for themselves. There are going to be a few people who own a lot of, you know, property or a lot of stock who aren't going to like that, or a lot of weapons that aren't going to like that, but it's time, I think, you know, the other thing that you have to say about this is that it doesn't work. I mean, what if the United States had been paying more attention to the Sahel? Well, we paid an awful lot of attention to Afghanistan, so how did that work? How do you like the way Iraq worked out, where we paid a lot of attention? What if we had been paying more attention to the Sahel? So what? We would have done more military stuff, and the opposition would have gotten more militarily sophisticated. And every time you fly a drone over somebody's territory and people get killed, even if it's not collateral damage, you know, even if it's the people you wanted to kill, the people in that territory think, my God, we don't have any power and we don't have any honor here if they can do this to us. I mean, you just have to think for a minute how we would feel if somebody's flying drones over Kansas or, you know, or New York. And if the excuse, as they blew up somebody's car or building, and the excuse was, well, we killed a drug dealer, or we killed somebody that you'll agree to was, you didn't like him either. we would say, we don't care whether it was a good guy or a bad guy. We just know that you're presuming to run things over here. And that's what we're mainly tired of. So I think the fact that you allow people with what I think is a vicious ideology in many ways, you know, the jihadist ideology, that you allow them to capture the sentiment of people around the world who really want autonomy, who want independence, want to make their own decisions. This is the real crime, it seems to me. This is what's really wrong with the drones and the rest of these sophisticated ways of fighting a war, that we shouldn't fight the war. We should find out how to deliver to people what they most need, which is autonomy and dignity.
Well, I perhaps have misrepresented Ambassador Huddleston. She may not have entirely thought that it was all about targeting the jihadis before they grew into an army, and more about taking care of this incredibly impoverished country and helping it. But one of the things that did come up in the interview was we talked about Algeria and that the Algerians were dead against the U.S. intervention in Libya. And she said, well, probably for the right reason, because look what happened.
Yeah.
So this leads you to the broader question, which is, what do you do about the people like Milosevic, these, criminals and genocidal people, and the Assad family, and the Gaddafi murderous kleptocracy? Because if your point is well taken, that the intervention ends up creating a whole new set of problems, but that's not to say that accommodating or coexisting with these hideous regimes is morally acceptable as well.
Right. It's sort of like asking the question, if you have a bad guy in the neighborhood, but there's no legal system to deal with him, what do you do? And then we could argue about, well, vigilantism, might be the answer, but then vigilantism creates lots of problems because people all, name themselves vigilantes and do what they want. In the case of the kind of the international bad guys, what's required is ultimately is an international system that's a real international system, not as kind of some institutions that are puppets of global capital and Western political interests, that would be in a position to say, we got some genocide starting over here, we got to stop it. When you look around the world and you say, you ask the question, well, when did the great power stop genocides? When did they intervene and so forth? The answer is only when their own interests dictated it. They didn't do a thing in Rwanda. In fact, the West made it worse in Rwanda because there was no money to be made by, put it frankly, by intervening there. So what's desperately needed is a legitimate system that would permit international intervention in case to save masses of innocent lives in situations in which they're endangered. And you don't have that kind of system. You have this picking and choosing system now in which, since Libya has oil, we go in and get rid of Gaddafi, but some other place doesn't have anything worth trading, so the hell with them. And also, because we know from, I talk in my book about this and Reasons to Kill about it, but we know that when powers like the United States intervene, even though they are sincere about their humanitarian reasons for intervening, as the U.S. was in Cuba, let's say, or in the Spanish-American War, they come as liberators and they end as occupiers and exploiters. In fact, they end up a kind of weird simulacrum of the bad guys that they had meant to replace, that they had said that they were replacing. So since that doesn't work, now you say, well, but we have emergencies now. We have Assad and so forth going on now, so we can't wait. And then my response to that would, yes, you do. You have to wait. I mean, until you have a legitimate system of intervention, if you're going to then say, appoint yourself the savior of humanity to pick and choose which atrocities you're going to prevent around the world, that's worse. It's because what that does is deprive local people of the... I often wonder, what if kind of current institutions had been in existence at the time of the American Civil War? I mean, could you see the headlines? Could you see the debate in the UN? Sherman marches on Atlanta. American generals are killing American civilians. Sherman burns Atlanta. Wouldn't you have international intervention? Wouldn't you have NATO, you know, wouldn't you have drones over Atlanta to stop Sherman from marching to the sea?
Well, but you did have international intervention in the form of European powers happily to sell their arms to both sides.
Well, that's true. But, you know, of course, the English, for a while, were
supporting the
South.
With
all due respect, they were talking about intervening on the side of the Confederacy for a while because of the cotton trade.
Sure, sure. But, well, look, we've run out of time. You've made some very, very interesting points, and I wish we had more time, but unfortunately we don't, Richard Rubenstein, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Rubenstein, who's a university professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. He's the author of 8 books, including When Jesus Became God and Aristotle's Children. His most recent book is Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.